I want to call the House Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2057. Janet, can you get us up to speed, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. House Bill 2057 was the bill heard last week that would replace the temporary or special event liquor sales license fee that is currently $25 per five-hour period with a fee of $50 per day. And it would also allow temporary licensees to have alcohol serving areas set aside where minors would be prevented from access. There was discussion at the hearing related to the fee, the daily fee for a permit license, a special event permit license, and there was some discussion of lowering the fee to $25 a day, and that you'll see in the dash one amendments. And the dash three amendments are rewording section two to clarify that if there is any portion of the event area that is set aside for persons of drinking age to consume alcohol, the applicant must include a plan for preventing minors access to that area. The bill, just for the record, for the new wording does not require that such an area be set aside, but the applicant will be required to have a satisfactory plan for preventing minor access to alcohol, whether or not an area is set aside. And Mr. Chair, John Steubenville is here if you wish to call him up during the work session to talk about either of the amendments.
And I misspoke. I opened a public hearing and want to open a work session on House Bill 2057. And John, could we have just come up and talk, tell us about the amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. John Steubenville, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Chair, let's start with the dash threes. Those are probably easier. As the administrator stated, the dash threes simply clarify language in the existing bill pertaining to the so-called beer garden provision. This is an attempt to clarify that the liquor license applicant has the option of having a beer garden or not. But under either case, whether the applicant has a beer garden or not, the applicant must submit a plan for approval to the OLCC containing information about how minors will be prevented from gaining access to alcohol. That's the dash three amendment. And the dash one amendment really is a policy question for the committee as to the appropriate fee level. The OLCC staff indicates that the $25 fee level would roughly cover the costs of issuing the license, processing the license, but would not cover the full costs of issuing the license and spot check enforcement, liquor law compliance efforts around those licenses. That cost, by our research, would be roughly $64 per license, per special event license, encompassing the full costs, in other words, processing and spot check compliance activities.
Thank you, John. Any questions, John? Representative Kitts.
John, so currently, because I've never applied for one of these licenses, is there a process that's different for the five-hour versus the all-day, or is it merely checking off a box indicating that this license is for 5 hours, or checking off a different box indicating that this license is for all day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, really the process for the application itself is very similar. It's, you know, as you stated, it's pretty much what's the difference in time and some other logistical type information. Really, the difference would be on after that license is issued, event by event. There'll be a case by case spot check compliance difference. In other words, for an event that's, you know, a couple hours with a small number of people, a wine reception in a museum or an art gallery, there's going to be a difference there versus a long weekend festival in on the waterfront in downtown Portland. Obviously, we're going to look at those differently when it comes to spot checks of enforcement. The other thing I might just mention, Mr. Chair, is this is as all of OLCC's legislative concepts, we ran these through the business partners group well in advance of the session. So it's my understanding that the retailers, the wholesalers, the producers, the industry folks have signed off on the concept that came before you. So it's my understanding that the fee level that's in the current bill has not raised objections with folks in the industry.
Follow up. I would also note that the people that Mr. Steubenbaugh just mentioned are not the purchasers of this particular fee. Why not raise it to $64 then and not $50 to cover the cost?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, that's a good policy question, really. The way the liquor license structure works overall is that the liquor license fees really are subsidized by the sale of at retail level of bottled distilled spirits. Really, that's how OLCC, in the big picture, pays its administrative costs, is through the sale of bottled distilled spirits. And other revenues collected by OLCC are really much smaller in percentage terms to the overall revenue collected by the agency.
Mr. Chair, in light of the information that we have now from fiscal regarding the impact, I won't object to the $50 being the set fee as opposed to reducing it down to $25. Obviously, I don't want these costs passed on. So with that, I will relinquish, if you will, my objection to the $50 if you don't want to move in the dash. Ones, if it's okay with the committee.
Thank you, Representative. And this bill does have a referral to Ways and Means, so that we looked at the second time around. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that'd like to testify on 2057? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, are we referring this motion to refer with the due pass to Ways and Means, or are we referring to the floor?
I'd like to see you move the dash three amendments.
I'd like to do that first, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move the committee accept and move in the dash three amendments to House Bill 2057.
Representative Kitts moves the dash three amendments to 2057. Is there any discussion? Katie, can you call the roll, please?
Representative
Escobar.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Yes.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. The next three amendments are adopted into House Bill 2057. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2057 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2057 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, please call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Yes.
Representative
Thank
Holden.
You. Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
No.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. It is 2057 and it's sent to Ways and Means. And I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2214. And Janet, please let us know what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2214 is the revision to a large bill that passed last session. House Bill 2341, which was the public contracting revision bill that came through a formalized work group that was formed by the 2001 legislature, and it was a major rewrite of the public contracting statutes. The bill you have before you will be covered section by section from the Department of Justice. It does modify and make technical corrections as well as some substantive changes to the public contracting statutes. I listed on the top part of the staff measure summary where the sections are and where the changes are, and I don't think I'll read through that, but you can use that as a reference to the sections in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
We have one, too.
I think that's a different bill.
Yeah.
We have signed up the test fire. Dana Anderson, please. Good morning, Dana.
Morning.
Please help us understand what's going on.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I will attempt to do that. My name is Dana Anderson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, 1162 Court Street Northeast, Salem 97310. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2214. It's a Department of Justice law improvement proposal, primarily consisting of technical amendments to the new public contracting code. The public contracting code was adopted in 2003, as your staff indicates, and it was a complete rewrite of a 30-year-old set of confusing and conflicting public purchasing laws. The code comprises three new chapters of Oregon revised statutes. It was over 200 pages in length. And because of the hundreds of people and dozens of work groups that were involved, we knew there would likely be some glitches in the system. And the co-chairs of that effort, wisely enough, determined that a March 1, 2005 operative date would be best so that we would have a chance to come back and present to this session technical corrections and things that would otherwise make the code work better. We knew we would find those as we scoured the code on the state and local levels in preparing rules to implement it, including the Attorney General model public contract rules that are required by the code. I worked with the co-chairs of the drafting committee on the rewrite of ORS Chapter 279 in 2002 and 2003, and I coordinated the development of model public contract rules in the Department of Justice. So I have maintained over this period of time the central log for state agencies and local governments to have a placeholder for technical amendments to the code. That log has been widely distributed by groups such as the Oregon Project Directors Association, the Oregon Public Contracting Coalition, and various continuing legal education programs. So it's been the focal point of all the effort in getting the technical amendments. And then we finally coordinated with legislative counsel during the drafting process, of course, and the final result now appears before you as House Bill 2214. I have written testimony which outlines the 15 points of the bill. I can give you some examples, or I can run you through all 15. Unless I hear a request to run through all of them, I'll give you some examples. Maybe that would be shorter.
We'll take the examples.
Okay. There were some erroneous references, for instance, to economically depressed areas in the code and in the current statutes on public purchasing, whereas the base laws that deal with that talk about economically distressed areas. Not a big deal, but it lines up the terminology. We had designations of personal service contracts squared away for how local governments do it through local contract review boards, but we had several statutory references back to a specific statute in the code about how state agencies do it. That specific statute didn't answer the question. It was just silent. So we have added that each state contracting agency can designate personal service contracts. This is consistent with how the Department of Administrative Services wanted to handle it. They didn't want to be in the central position on such a basic contract administration issue. We clarified that in making emergency contracts for public improvements, you don't need to go through a separate formal process once you make the formal declaration of emergency. Just things to aid in the interpretation of the code. We did some consistency checks, adding notice of intent to award, for instance, for competitively bid contracts, as well as when you have competitive proposals. Made some technical corrections on bond requirements, and we added a threshold of $50,000 for that, and that may be what your committee staff indicates is a substantive change. We not only had technical corrections that were very obvious in the code, but we have a few cases where, in order to administer the code, it makes more sense for the code to say when you're not in a formal procurement like invitation to bid or request for proposals, and the code allows you to use informal competitive quotes, at that level you don't need to get the formal bonds, rather than to have every public contracting agency have to enact a class exemption. So that that is one of those areas. We also identified several contract provisions that, although they're in the chapter of the code that deals with public improvement contracts, they still say every public contract shall contain a provision. So we've gone through there and just clarified for the casual reader, doesn't have to trace back the applicability of each of these chapters, that we're talking about public improvement contracts, not really all public contracts. This is sort of like an Easter egg hunt, in that we knew we were out there finding all these glitches and collecting them as fast as we could for pre-session filing deadlines. But for the Department of Justice, that pre-session filing deadline comes fairly early. So we continued to collect the eggs, and we know that we will have an amendment to this, and I will characterize what the amendment does in just a moment. The critical part of this is timing, because the code takes effect on March 1, 2005. And so we really want to get the technical amendments in place by that time. Legislative Council is currently drafting an amendment to this measure. And the way our legislative folks explain it to me is, if we can get the House to move this basic version, we can have the Senate committee then add in the amendments once Legislative Council finalizes the draft, and then have the House concur in that. I don't represent that that's a correct statement of the system, but that's at least as I understand it, so that we can get to the 3105 date for both things. That amendment does several things, one of which is our basic guiding principle is that all the folks that have been involved in our work groups on this basically have a veto power, and where we hear that there is some concern about one of the technical amendments, we delete it and we'll handle it in some other fashion. So, for instance, there is a provision that would allow performance and payment bonds in the base measure you have before you to be submitted on separate phases where you have a multi-phase public improvement project, and also make some technical corrections to the ODOT bonding authority. We heard through the Associated General Contractors that some folks in the construction surety industry wanted to talk about that a little bit before it moved forward. So the amendment to HB 2214 would delete this provision from the base bill. Just to run through what those log of additional changes that Legislative Council is working on, so that you know that they're of the same ilk as the base bill. The $50,000 threshold for the bonding capacity we would change after AGC concurred in making this change. They had a concern originally that the low threshold for competitive quotes ought to be not 100,000 across the board as originally proposed, but ought to be 100,000 except for transportation projects for roads, highways, bridges, and such. So we have a split on the 279C side for construction about when you use competitive quotes. We want to line up the bonding authority so you don't need to go through the formal part of getting performance and payment bonds if you're under the competitive quote level, whichever threshold applies. There was an erroneous reference to a judicial review. We have several in 279B non-construction. We have several protest and judicial review procedures, and apparently there was a misidentification of one of those. We have a request from ODOT that sole source procurement authority not just be vested in Department of Administrative Services and local boards, but like many other parts of the code, that ODOT and other contracting agencies ought to be able, as part of contract administration, to designate sole source contracts. And we concur in that. The Department of Forestry has a concern about a misstatement on the current scope of forest products exemption. That's an important program area for them, and we don't want to misstate it, so that is in the corrections. Likewise, Bowley has a concern about hours of labor and whether they are correctly stated, not on the construction side, but on the goods and services side in 279B. And we're working with them to correctly state that. There are a series of technical fixes on the goods and services side in 279B, including when you have public notice for special procurements, to allow that to be electronic to accommodate the DAS ORPIN system, which is their, I'm not sure what the initials stand for, but it's their electronic system for procurement, and so we want to accommodate that. There were some little syntax problems that folks were concerned about. We have a definition of established catalog price, but we find we don't use it anywhere in the code, so it would make sense to get rid of the definition. There's some differing undefined terms that characterize bids or proposals in a multi-step bidding and proposals, so we would clarify that. Another case where contract administration allows the director of DAS or a local contract review board to authorize electronic procurement, and ODOT requests that they be allowed to authorize it as well. And there are several places in the code where we give ODOT authority, and it makes sense to do it there. We exempt in certain cases contracts from bonding requirements, but we don't do the next step, and also exempt it from bid security. And so it corrects that by lumping those together. Typically, they're lumped together so that you can exempt classes of contracts or individual contracts from both. And so that was an oversight. Also, we want to allow the Oregon University system to exempt contracts from bid security and bonding requirements. A glitch in the current law, as well as the restatement in the code, has the Oregon University system subject to only part of our public contracting laws. One of them is the bonding requirement. But unfortunately, it didn't also pick up the exemption from bonding. So we want to formalize the fact that the Oregon University system has the same authority as everyone else to exempt classes of contracts or specific contracts from bonding. So that is a characterization of both the base bill and the amendment that is coming. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of work. Has the representative from the Eugene Water Enhancement Board spoken to you about their problems with it yet? You didn't mention that one, did you?
No. Chair Brown and Representative Schaffler, yes, we had a hallway conversation about that. And we'll be following up with those folks. The current status of the law, by virtue of a measure passed independent of the code revision, either in the last session or the one before it, recognized energy savings performance contracts and said that the Department of Justice shall promulgate a rule about them in consultation with certain entities, including the Oregon University system. And then agencies that follow that rule are exempt from competitive bidding. And that was, that's the law on the books as we sit here today before the code goes into effect. And we promulgated the model rule as required, and so that's on the books today. When Legislative Council was putting the whole code together, there was a reference to energy savings performance contracts being exempt from the whole code, everything completely, rather than from competitive bidding if you follow the model rule. So that was an unintended change. And I think Eugene Water and Electric Board and some others now are concerned because they've tracked that in the code, and they think that's the current status when, in fact, it's an erroneous change that wasn't discussed by the revision committee.
You know, all this stuff going on here, I don't know how many hearings we had on it 2 years ago, but are you, you know, I know you're under the gun. One, how long is it going to take you to get all this stuff fixed if we didn't do anything today? And what happens if you don't meet the March 1st deadline?
If we don't get it fixed through this process, we will miss the 3105 date. And what will happen is that the code will become operative on 3105, but these technical amendments, of course, then wouldn't follow it. And all the things that I outlined won't change. It'll just make it more difficult to interpret and administer the code. So it's the hope of the folks that have to live with it and administer it that these things will be adopted.
Any other questions, Adina? Representative Holdy.
Getting back to the energy savings performance contracts, can you give me an example of, you know, why would we not exempt them from the entire code and just from competitive bidding? I mean, what's the difference between being exempted from the competitive bidding and then being exempted from the entire code? What effect does that have on those sorts of contracts?
The policy questions about exempting it from competitive bidding rather than all public contracting laws was made at committee hearings and that I wasn't a party to. So, but I can tell you, so I don't know what the underlying policy decision was at that point. I can tell you the effect of exempting it from the entire code is you won't have a requirement for any competition. You could hire your brother-in-law to do the project if you want. You won't have a requirement for any kinds of bonds, which would be of a concern to the building trades and others because they wouldn't have recourse, for instance, if a sub or supplier is not paid on a public works project. You wouldn't have public notice of the thing. In the event that you didn't follow the model rule and you did something outside the normal flow on that kind of a public improvement, you wouldn't be required to get an exemption from competitive bidding, which means you wouldn't have to follow the public notice and hearing requirements that are built into the current law. I know they're just some off the top, but there are lots of similar requirements.
Representative Shaw?
Yeah, forgive me. I don't think I heard your answer of how long it's going to take you to get this all squared away if we wanted to wait until we voted on amendment. I asked that, and I have a two-part question.
Chair Brown, Representative Shuffler, if you're asking how long it would take us to get this enacted...
No, to get all this amendment that you're talking about that's going to go through all those bullets, when are you going to have that ready?
I don't have a definitive answer from Legislative Council, but they are working on it. I know they're working overtime on it.
But I
don't anticipate that we would have that for a week or 10 days. And so that would, I think, be very problematic then to be able to get the measure out of committees on both sides and adopted, signed by the governor, in time to meet the 3105 timeline. So that would leave a number of public procurements in the lurch as to what they're supposed to do, where there are some of these gaps. For instance, how does the state agency designate a personal service contract? There's no answer currently in the code.
Any other questions, Adina?
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Shield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, can you give me I'm a rookie here, so there are a couple of things I need to know in the history to make a good decision here. Can you give me a typical example of an energy savings performance contract and any Oregon companies particularly that might be involved in that?
Chair Brown, Representative Shields, I cannot name the Oregon companies. I know that we coordinated our rule with several of them, but I wasn't involved in that process. Colleagues in my business transactions section were. But an energy savings performance contract would typically involve an energy audit of an existing building and a recommended work plan from a recognized energy savings performance contractor as to what they could do to increase the energy efficiency of the building. And then if that work plan were accepted, it would entail amendments or additional contracts that would be part of the bundle for the ESPC procurement, so that they would then actually perform the public improvement. In some cases, they would be paid whether or not the improvements save what is anticipated. In other cases, there's a guarantee, and they are only paid out of the savings. So there's varieties of them. That's one of the reasons why I think that the measure was passed in a prior session, that it ought to be regulated at least to the extent that there's a norm established by the model public contract rules, and if that norm is followed, then you don't need to have a competitive bidding process.
So what you're saying is that this particular bill does not will not allow for no bid contracts because the Attorney General model rules will apply. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Brown, Representative, I don't understand. Won't allow any bid contracts?
No bid.
Oh, no bid contracts.
I mean, are they? Will they non-competitive contracts? Perhaps would that be better terminology.
As the code was enacted, it would completely set free the procurement of energy savings performance contracts. Be no requirement for any competition or public notice at all, which is not the status of the current law and wasn't the intent of the legislature in passing the current regulation of ESPCs.
Okay, so one last thing, Mr.
Chairman.
Thank you. So this bill, 2214, will allow non-competitive contracts, and 2341, was that part of 2341 as well?
No, I can't recall what House bill it was in the prior session, but there was a small bill that specifically addressed energy savings performance contracts. House Bill 2341, which enacted the public contracting code, erroneously tried to restate that law, but it did it in the wrong place. And the unintended result is to take it completely out of the public contracting code.
With this bill.
As the law currently is, this bill would correct that erroneous reference. The erroneous reference is taken completely out of the code. The intent of the legislature, expressed by the ESPC legislation passed on its own, was to take it out of competitive bidding, provided that the agency followed the model public contract rule in doing that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, Mr. Dana?
I have.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, I noticed that the bullet number 10 talking about contracting agencies making an estimate of contract value and determining whether first-tier subcontractor disclosure submissions are required. Can you explain, does that, you know, a first-tier subcontractor, does that also include their subcontractors, or why aren't second-tier, third-tier also included in that clarification?
There's Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, there is a delicate balance in the current laws between some competing forces, which are prime contractors and the building trade subcontractors, about disclosure. And it only applies to first-tier subcontractors of the prime contractor, and the intent of that law, although it's not expressed in the statutes, is to limit bid shopping. The current statutes on that say that contracts with a value in excess of $100,000 are estimated to be in excess of $100,000. It doesn't say who does the estimate. Our model public contract rule says the contracting agency is the one who does the estimate, because they, after all, put the disclosure form in the packet, or they don't. They directed it be followed or not. So this just clarifies that since someone's going to make the estimate, it ought to be the contracting agency that makes this. But it doesn't change the substantive relation between the primes and the subs in that delicate area.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess what I'm getting at is that if a second-tier subcontractor is included in the first tier subcontractor's estimate of value?
When the prime contract, Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, when a prime contractor gets pricing from their first tier subcontractors, the pricing that that first tier sub will give will include whatever subs and suppliers that they might have, but they're not disclosed in this process.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Dana. Appreciate your testimony. Christine Hammond, please.
Good morning. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to testify today on behalf of the Bureau regarding House Bill 2214. You're being provided a copy of a letter from Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner pertaining to this bill. As you know, what is now ORS Chapter 279 has undergone a major reorganization as directed by the 2001 legislature. House Bill 2341, which was passed last session, will become effective March 1st of this year. Boley participated in the work group that worked on the drafting and reorganization of the public improvements section of ORS 279, which has become 279C. The Bureau's primary concerns related to the prevailing wage rate law in the redrafting of the public contracting code. The prevailing wage rate law applies to public works contracts that are covered currently in ORS Chapter 279. There are other provisions in 279, however, that deal with employees of contractors not on public works projects subject to the prevailing wage rate law, and those are in the B section of the rewritten code. We're specifically concerned about provisions that are currently in ORS 279334 relating to hours of labor and the payment of overtime to employees of contractors. And the provisions of 334 have been recodified in both the C and B sections of the rewritten code. We're okay with the adoption of the current law in the C section, but the law has been changed in the B section. We thought that the changes were inadvertent, but we're not sure that that's the case at this point. We're currently working with the Department of Justice and Legislative Council to restore the provisions of 279334 in B. As testimony pertaining to House Bill 2341 will confirm, last session we understood that there were to be no substantive changes to the provisions of 279, so we're concerned with what we see as a substantive change to the overtime provisions in B. Our understanding is this matter will be addressed in the amendments that Legislative Council is currently working on. And again, we're working with both the Department of Justice and Legislative Council to address those concerns. Any questions?
And so, Christine, the issues that you have aren't corrected in 2214.
Chair,
there are some amendments that you're preparing. Representative Schlaffer.
Thank you. Do you have an idea on what kind of impact it would have on a worker's overtime pay? I mean, can you give me an example of what kind of impact it'll have on that if it went through as it
Chair
is right now?
Brown, Representative Schaffler, yes, the daily overtime requirements that are currently contained in ORS 279334 are not included in ORS 279B020. O20 would only require overtime to be paid after 40 hours are worked in a week, and there is no daily overtime requirement.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Harris. morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. For those of you that aren't as familiar with us as others, we are 1,100 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We build your roads and bridges and schools and other public facilities, so we have a great interest in Oregon's public contracting code. Last session, we were very involved in the passage of 2341 and in the work groups coming to it. I'm sure you never knew that Oregon's public contracting code could be as controversial and as exciting as it is today. Representative Schaffler sat on the committee last session and enjoyed more testimony and involvement in this bill than I think he ever imagined he would have in the passage of a piece of legislation.
And I'm grateful to continue to enjoy it.
Representative Schaffler, would you like to just make sure this bill stays here for a while?
Sounds looking that way.
Go ahead, Jim.
This issue last session, just to give a little bit of background on how the bill came to be in the first place. The bill, as Dana Anderson has indicated, came from the fact that we had a statute, and ORS 279, as it's currently in effect today, is 30 years old and, quite frankly, a mess. It didn't allow public agencies to purchase supplies, things like computers and pencils and paper and things that, quite frankly, the contractors don't care about efficiently. But it also protected what a statute was designed to do, which is create a fair and competitive bidding process for public improvements, roads and bridges and schools, effectively. So public agencies would come and say, we need to make this change so that we can be more efficient. But in making that change, and that proposed change would make a problem for the construction industry, and we just did this for a really long time fighting with each other. So we sat down and decided, you know, the best way to handle this is to divide the chapter and create a section for construction, leaving the code generally in place as it is, a section for public purchasing, 279B, that changes the statute to make it more friendly for public agencies to efficiently and cost-effectively purchase goods and services. The idea being that the C side, the construction side, would not change substantively because the deals and the agreements in C are so carefully negotiated and highly controversial that we just wouldn't go there or we wouldn't have a bill. But the 279B side, there was a process by which we had numerous work groups and hours of negotiation and more time than anyone ever thought possible, working on how do we change that so we can cost effectively do public purchasing. So it was always the intention that there would be substantive changes in 279B. It was all the way along. There were changes that some people now looking at the bill are unhappy with, and that's the purpose of 2214 and these conversations that are ongoing to try and sort those issues out. 279A, here reference to that, that is the portion of statute that applies to both construction and public purchasing. There are numerous provisions that do. This bill is an attempt to make technical corrections, things that we thought were right but turns out didn't. You've heard the conversation on energy savings performance contracts. That bill, we were more tangentially involved. That bill passed during the last session, late in the session, was signed by the governor. And as you know, there has to be this reconciliation process by which you add in bills and make the law work together, or otherwise you end up with something exempting something else that was meant to be. Well, when Legislative Council was hurriedly finishing what were, I think, a 50-page amendment at the end, trying to reconcile bills that already passed and make the last substantive changes, there was, we believe, to be an error that we were trying to fix in here that has caused concern on the part of EWEB and others. Again, our commitment is to work that out. The intention was to leave them in the same place that they were when they passed the bill, which is exempted from the process of competitive bidding, so they can go out and do a request for proposal or a sole source procurement or one of those methods, but not to exempt them from the bonding requirements and the labor and hour requirements and all of those things that are currently in 279. We believe that when but in the way that legislative council drafted it, it exempted them from the code altogether. It is a policy choice on your part. If that's how you want it to stay, quite frankly, AGC has no position one way or the other on that. We're just trying to explain why we brought it back in the way we did, because we believe that to be an error. Like I said, there are the goal of this bill is to clarify some of the issues that we thought we had solved, one of which I'm not sure Dana covered, relates to permissive contracts. These are essentially piggyback contracts that agencies are allowed to do. One agency sets up a contract with a contractor, and another agency says, you know, that's a really good price. I would like to enter into the same agreement that you've already established. And current law allows that to happen. But the way 279-2341 was written, and when March 1st hits, it is confusing, and it appears to allow for public improvement contracts, construction contracts, for agencies to do the same thing. That was never our intention. In fact, we specifically negotiated so that wouldn't be the case. But errors in drafting are bound to happen in a 200-page bill. And that was the goal of trying to make 2214 work. We never intended to surprise anybody. This bill has been around, and this list has been around for a while. We apologize for some of the confusion that has arisen, and you have our commitment on part of AGC to work those issues out. We don't want to move a bill that's controversial or a problem. Appears that we have created an issue, and we apologize to the committee for what we thought was a non-issue bill all of a sudden becoming a rather large issue. With that, I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Jessica. Representative Kitt.
Jessica, I just wanted to say for the record that I accept your apology.
Is there anyone else? Any other questions? Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, Jessica, when we talked about this, some of my colleagues and I, it was, well, this Department of Justice just has to do some housekeeping. And this ain't housekeeping. You know, overtime pay, you know, that's really a sensitive issue with me. And this timeline, I want to ask you the same question I did, Mr. Anderson. What kind of impact are you going to see this out in your industry that you represent if this goes over the March 1st deadline? I mean, is that going to be the end of the world? Is a few days going to make a difference? That's because I'm. If it was housekeeping, I wouldn't mind shoving it right through and taking care of it. I'm being real blunt here in the camera, but this isn't housekeeping, and I don't want to. I have real difficulties with it as it is right now. So what's it going to be? What's the impact on the state going to be if we go a few days over that deadline?
For the construction industry, Representative Brown, Representative Schaffler, it's a minor headache. It isn't the kind of major issue. But as we're talking about overtime pay requirements, if the legislature doesn't act before March 1st, the concerns that that Christy Hammond has raised will go into effect effective March 1st. To give the committee a reason, here's the reason why those changes were made. When on the purchasing side, and again, this is as I understand it, talking with folks that deal with the purchasing side, I'm not a purchasing side expert, but the understanding I have is that when you're talking about purchasing pencils or paper or something that comes from out of state and indeed is manufactured overseas, it is difficult to impose the same overtime requirements and maneuver the contracting process with those companies because you cannot guarantee that they are able to meet the same overtime, daily overtime requirements that we have imposed on public improvement contracts, and we're fine and dandy with those. We understand the rules, and we're not asking to change those. So what the legislature did last session, and this has been part of the bill since it was first amended, was to say that those contracts and the overtime and labor requirements on those companies must be in compliance with the Fair Labor Standards Act. So it wasn't to say you don't have to pay your workers, and you don't have to pay them a fair wage, and you don't have to pay them overtime, but that they wouldn't adhere to the same criteria that we have here in Oregon law. I understand that that causes some concern, and that's why there is a conversation happening to try and rectify that concern. But if this bill goes into effect March 1st, 2005, those changes will automatically happen for contracts entered into between March 1st, 2005 and whenever the bill is. So that's the net effect.
Just so I can clarify this too. If I voted yes on this as it sits right now, the language in there that Ms. Hammond's concerned about would go into effect. With the amendments to this, we would fix that. But I haven't seen the amendments.
Amendments aren't. That's correct. The amendments are not crafted yet. It's my understanding that Foley, DOJ, and DAS are meeting in the immediate future to negotiate that.
Well, may I please
follow up?
That's a big leap of faith for me.
I understand.
I just want to share that with you, and I don't think I'm there.
And Representative Brown and Representative Schaffler, if the bill doesn't move today, that, like I said, it's a minor headache for the construction industry. If the bill isn't enacted before March 105, those changes go into effect regardless. So I'm not trying to push one way or the other. I'm just letting you know that negotiation and movement on this bill will effectuate the change that you're looking at perhaps faster. My concern is about contracts. If an agency is watching and wants to move that as of March 1.
All right, one more, Mr. Chair.
Jessica, as I understand it, the overtime issue, if this bill is not passed and then with the amendments on it, will be in statute.
Correct.
So the issue that Representative Schaffler is concerned about will not be fixed if we don't do this, right?
That's correct. And don't do it as quickly as possible.
I just want to clarify that, too. The amendment will fix.
Correct.
If we don't, the original 2 years goes into effect.
Correct.
But what I have here doesn't fix what we did 2 years ago.
No, it's our understanding.
So just so I can clarify this, excuse me, then. And then if there is a delay, there would be a few days, and then the amendments would fix it. So the overtime that would be applied to those workers would just be for those days. So personally, I'd rather wait and have those workers paid less overtime for those small amount of days, and then the law take care of it, rather than me assuming with a leap of faith voting yes that it's going to get fixed, and maybe it won't get fixed, and then they could go years without the right overtime pay. That could happen. It's within the realm of possibility.
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, like I said, it's fine with us, and either way, just so that you're aware, it is any contract entered into between March 1 and whenever this is signed. So if a contract is entered into for a two-year stint, those workers would not have overtime. So, I mean, that's... like I said, I'm not trying to encourage the committee to act one way or the other with regards to this issue. We, again, apologize for the confusion. We thought we were clear last session as we were working this bill, and we didn't mean to surprise anybody or concern anybody. We, again, our attempt was to put them in line with Fair Labor Standards Act so that, again, people were guaranteed overtime and operating under the same rules as any other employer in the state is required to operate if they aren't on a public improvement contract. We apologize for the confusion and are committed to working it out. And in whatever timeline this committee would like us to operate, we're just trying to give you a sense of what the net effect of a non-March 1st signing would do. But that is a policy choice on your part, and we respect that either way.
Jessica, then the way the process works, as I understand it, if we pass this bill out, it goes to the floor, and it ends, and it goes to the Senate committee, there's a commitment to make these amendments to straighten this out, the issues that aren't addressed in 2214, and then at that time it will come back to the House floor for concurrence on the amendment, and so we have another bite out of the apple at that time to be assured that it's what we want, and the concerns that Representative Schaffler, at that time we could determine if they're there, and in fact even continue to amend the bill there in the conference committee, right?
Chair Brown, absolutely, and we make a commitment to involve Representative Schaffler in these negotiations to make sure that his concerns are absolutely met. We want to make you happy, Representative, and do anything
That's
we can
not about
to do
my
that.
Happiness. I wish it was.
And make sure that the law is as folks intended it to be. So,
and Mr. Chair, I have the greatest respect for Jessica Harris Adamson, and I trust her, and I'm not against your clients. I'm just, you have to, I hope I express my concerns in a respectful way.
Absolutely. Representative, we understand, and we want to make sure those concerns are met and that we resolve them along with concerns that Foley has and labor has. We don't want to leave people feeling like they were left behind or that the law is not working in a way that protects workers and companies and the state. So that's our goal. Chair Brown, you're absolutely correct. You have a bite at the apple again to pull us back in here on our ear if we are unable to speak that.
Representative Esquivel.
No, I was just going to reiterate a little bit here about the other bite of the apple here. So, but you beat me to it.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Jessica? Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Libby Henry. Libby Henry, please. I forgot what this one is.
Libby.
Good morning again.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Libby Henry, and I'm representing the Eugene Water and Electric Board. We're a municipal utility. We serve water and power to the citizens of Eugene. We have our separately elected board, and we have a board that does function as its own public contract review board. I understand there was a drafting error with regard to these exempting these energy savings performance contracts totally under the public contracting code. We don't need that. We support the idea of the exemption, specifically speaking to competitive bidding. But when you look at the rule on this, and remember, the goal here is to keep these contracts costs down, because we're trying to do conservation in Eugene with public bodies and private industry as well. When you do those kind of, you install those kind of measures, it's expensive. And the more expensive it is, the less likely people are going to want to install them. So we want to keep the cost low. When I look to the rule here regarding energy savings performance contracts and the exemption so stated, it says that these contracts may be exempted from the competitive bidding process for public improvement contracts pursuant to RS 279C335 if the contracting agency complies with the procedures set forth in, and it lists the OAR, which I have here, which is about 40 pages of rules. So what I'm wondering is, I can understand that the intent was never to exempt us from the entire code, and the intent was to exempt us from the rule, but what I need to know, and I will admit to you I don't understand, is do these 40 pages of rules do anything to help lower the cost of the contracts, exempted or not? So that's my question, and I will talk to the AG about that and my contracting people. And sorry to take your time as a result of a drafting error.
Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. I lost my sheets. I can't get it.
I didn't do it.
Dugan Petty, is that taken?
Dugan?
I must be pretty close. Somebody's coming up.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. I the Department of Administrative Services supports this amendment, and I think that Mr. Andrews, Mrs. Adamson have, I think, given you a pretty good background on the bill. The department has participated in two work groups. It might be useful to know that this is the result of really two interims worth of work group works on looking at really an overhaul of the public contracting code. It is, as Mrs. Adamson said, 30 years old. And while I think it works reasonably well on the construction side, it wasn't working very well on the other side, and that's why the split was made. I think there's tremendous efficiencies that have been built into the statute. And I think that even though it looks like there's a lot of technical correction and change that needs to be made, frankly, it's a tribute to the committee work and during the last session and to Legislative Council's drafting, but there really isn't more here. This is a 200-page bill with some substantive changes and some major rewrite, so it took a lot. And while I know that there are issues here that have to be resolved, I think that this is still a solid amendment and would recommend its passage. I might also say that as these work groups came together, and Ms. Adamson, as well as Sue Flobertantz from the City of Portland and myself acted as co-chairs with these work groups. And we did set up sub-work groups on this to deal with the various areas. One of the commitments we made on the 279C side, which is the public improvement construction side, was that there had to be absolute consensus on the changes that were made. And that consensus meant that any body participating in the work group had effectively veto ability. And so what you have on the 279 side, I think, represents really the balance of agreements that have served the contracting industry reasonably well. And there hasn't been much change there, although some formatting. On the 279B side and the A side, our agreement was to make substantive change, and that if it changed policy, that was part of what that was about. And we did bring policy changes forward. So there are more drastic changes on the 279B side. And part of the reason for that is because in the past we were trying to buy computer systems or pencils or paper or services contracts with consultants in the same manner we were trying to buy public works, public construction, and it didn't work nearly as well. So that's the reason for that bifurcation and the difference in the two. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. The department supports this. We're anxious for the bill to move. However, if it is delayed in this committee, we will work to resolve any of the differences to make sure that you've got an amendment that makes sense to move out. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. I appreciate it. Linda Ludwig, please.
Good morning, Mr.
Good morning.
Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, the League of Oregon Cities. The League spent many years, several interims, on the bill that you saw last session, as well as the other participants in those work groups. We have submitted to you some comments on the bill you have before you, the amendment to the large bill, this one, HB 2214. We forwarded just today these comments to Dana Anderson and everyone here so that they can be looked at in the process of the amendment that's being considered as we speak. Most of these comments are not of substance. They are just of technical legislative language wording. And we agree that time is of the essence at this point in time with the effective date of March 1st coming before us. Probably the issue of substance, and I don't want to go through all these comments, but before us today is the performance and payment bond threshold. That is something at the level of $50,000 that's going to be extremely hard for small cities. That's a lot of money to some cities. And the allowance of language to allow some of those contracting agencies to require bonds for smaller contracts is something we'd like to see. We are more than willing to work with the amendment and have these comments be included in that amendment. I guess in my comments to Representative Schaffler's concerns about the timeline, I think we would all say in hindsight, March 1st as an effective date for that bill was a very bad effective date. We're early into this session. That was a huge monumental bill that needed a long time for the model rules to come out, a lot of airing with all the parties that are affected by those rules, and we are up against deadlines. Cities right now are having a very difficult time. They're charging forward trying to adopt their ordinances that will bring online the large bill. The changes that you see before you today probably won't implicate those ordinances that they to a large extent in terms of having to make modifications later on. But this really is an effort that's screaming up right to the edge, and we probably ought to have given ourselves a little longer time.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Schaffler.
In my experience as a legislator, we could have made the date August 15th.
I hope not.
I went on.
Go ahead.
I think that's all I need to say, unless there are questions here.
The issues that you've raised in here in your testimony, the written testimony you've given us here, are in addition to the changes that Dana's requesting?
Yes, they are.
Is there any...
The change... Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Actually, there are three pages of issues here. They are largely repetitive issues, though, and they're probably only about six ones, mostly in terms of wording, I think, that came out of Legislative Council to make that wording a little more clearer in terms of the intent. So I think these changes are largely ones that can be folded into the amendment that we're currently discussing.
That Dana is working on now.
Yes.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Lisa Zavall. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Just wanted to let you know that I'm having a very brief conversation with Dana Anderson, but we'll be working with him in the amendments to address the issue he brought to your attention with regard to the Oregon University System exemptions. In addition, we will be looking at trying to correspond the changes in the 279B and C with our exemptions in ORS 351, so I'll be working with him. I just wanted to let you know that, so that hopefully we may see those in the amendments that he is working on.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you again for your testimony. Is there anyone else here that wants to testify on House Bill 2214? Please come. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning. Chair Brown, members of the committee, I apologize. It was very foggy between here and where I was this morning. I apologize for not signing up properly. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I represent the Fair Competition Alliance. This is a group of business owners and managers and also labor unions that have followed this contracting issue, the rewrite of the contracting codes of Oregon. We have found that in the rush to put the House Bill 2341 through last session, there may have inadvertently been an error in the legal remedies section. And unfortunately, I cannot give you the specifics of that today, but we'll be bringing that forward if you have the bill here or if it goes to the Senate side. There appears to be some sort of a loop in that legal remedies section that seems very unusual to our legal review folks, and I apologize I couldn't get the actual wording of it to you today, but we'll be presenting that at some point to determine whether that is an actual error. So I just wanted to let you know. Thank you.
You will be working with Dana then?
Yes, I'm sure we will, and with with Dugan Petty and with anyone at the AG's office as soon as we can get our legal review folks to complete their work. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2214? And then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2214. And very reluctantly, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2214 and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2214 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, obviously noting concerns of the committee that it will be amended on either side, and if in fact it comes back not to the satisfaction of the committee, we'll address it then. So, not so reluctantly, I move that we move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative.
Oh, excuse me, and rescind the subsequent referral, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2214 to the floor with and rescinds the referral to Ways and Means
Revenue.
Thank you. Is there any discussion, Representative Schaffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be voting yes, and some real nice people have assured me that this is going to come back to everybody's satisfaction, and I believe that. So I am taking a leap of faith. You've got to have faith, brother.
Any other comments? Committee, it's going to be an interesting floor speech that we made that we're passing a bill out 2214 to correct a lot of mistakes made next time, but there's a lot of mistakes still in it, and they will be addressed on the Senate side, and that will be a leap of faith.
Mr. Chair, please don't ask me to carry this bill, but I will be voting yes.
Representative Shields.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I'm still a little uncomfortable with the March 1st deadline, but I'm okay with the vote going forward. I'm just a little uncomfortable. I'll probably be voting no.
Thank you, Representative. And that's my whole reason for moving it on now, is that March 1st deadline. I'm not sure that it's obviously not within our ability to change that, Representative.
Mr. Chair, as one of two people on the committee that was on Business and Labor last time and dealt with the rewrite, I don't think it was a rush bill. I think it was a very thorough bill, very much vetted out. Obviously, we're seeing that it's not perfect, but I can tell you from working with these same folks that are giving us their word that they're willing to work on this, I think a good representative from Happy Valley as well would concur that we don't have a whole lot to worry about if the work they did last session is indicative of the work they'll be doing this session to make this right. So I think the committee on the floor can rest easy with that vote.
Thank you, Representative. And as we it was stated earlier, we will, when this, if the bill is amended on the Senate side, when it comes back to a conference committee on the House side, we'll have an opportunity to take a real good look at it again. Any other discussion? Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
No.
Representative
Alcaba. Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
A reluctant aye.
Chair Brown.
Votes aye. Motion carries. Representative Schaffler, would you mind carrying that? You seem to have the depth of knowledge.
I would be happy.
Besides, I should have fixed it last time.
My fault.
Is there anything else, Janet? You have any?
Maybe.
If well, nothing else, committee have anything else? We are adjourned.